This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 20th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Let's go ahead and take a look at what's happened in the past week in the area of federal taxes. And we're going to start out just giving you a little tip about something that you might find useful. This week, Google rolled out the Google Scholar button for the Google Chrome browser. If you use Chrome, and apparently these days about half of users are using Chrome, you actually can add a button that allows you to search Google Scholar. You may wonder why that's important. Well, scholar.google.com not only has papers on archaeology and the like, but if you change its default, it will go ahead and instead of returning those papers, those academic papers, it will give you court cases and legal documents. So what you can do by doing that is you'll have a direct from the toolbar ability to bring up court cases. And that is the full text of those cases. So it's a useful little tool. Doesn't cover all cases, but it covers the vast majority of cases that are published and certainly can be useful to fill in holes in your tax service. So if you're interested in that, go to our current federaltaxdevelopments.com website. We've got an article written up exactly how to add that in, or simply go into Google, into Chrome, and go into the App Store for Chrome and just tell it to go look for Google Scholar. And after you do that, you need to switch the settings. If you hit the settings button, you'll be sent to defaults. It can allow you to change it to cases. It will still default to those papers if you're not careful. But it's a useful little hint to know about. Now, having that done, we'll go ahead and we'll go forward now and actually talk about some developments here. First, we're going to talk about here is a case of Spear versus Commissioner, 144 TC number 4. That was issued on April the 16th. Now, this is an interesting case dealing with the issue of exclusion of workers' compensation payments under Section 104. And this case, in first glance, looks a lot like the case of Givens versus Commissioner, which is a 90 TC 1145 case. In both the case of Mr. Givens and Mr. Spear, the individuals in question were law enforcement officers in Southern California. In both cases, they had been involved with disabilities. And in both cases, the key issue that we're going to discuss here is going to be the issue of sick pay that they had accrued and that was paid out and how it related to their disability income. In the case of Mr. Givens, the tax court had determined that in his case, if he stayed basically after a year being disabled with the county he worked for, after a year of disability under the disability program that was held to be like a workers' comp program, the taxpayer would be paid an amount of his accrued sick leave, would be used as an extra payment on after that one-year anniversary. The tax court ruled that even though the IRS said, wait, this is a benefit that's available to everybody, you know, essentially you didn't have to be disabled to get this payout of sick pay because they pay out sick pay for various reasons. The tax court said, sorry, it doesn't matter that it's like it because in many ways, you know, the whole workers' comp is like your salary. But rather the question became whether it was paid as part of the program. They ruled it was and they excluded it. Now let's fast forward to Mr. Spear's case. Mr. Spear, he was a law enforcement officer. Two times during his career, he had been on disability. And the disability payments were treated as workers' comp payments, excluded from his income, no problem. Now, under the program he has with the LA Police Department, they have a program that when somebody retires, they are paid out an amount based on their unused sick leave. Now, sick leave, like in many places, is accrued over time. There's a maximum carryover amount, and Mr. Givens had been involved for years. So he had two periods of time, though, where he had been disabled. Under the LA program, it had been agreed in a memorandum with the union that sick pay would continue to be accrued while on disability, even though it could not be paid while the person was on disability. So he continued to accrue sick leave during those two periods. Now Mr. Spear retires. Again, not off disability, he just retires. When he retires, he gets paid an amount equal to half of his accrued but unused sick pay. He excludes a portion of that, saying that it related to his sick pay earned while he was on disability, and that as such, following the Speer case, this should be considered a workers' compensation payment. The tax court disagreed. The tax court pointed out that there are some specific differences that were important between what Mr. Speer had and what Mr. Givens had had. First thing was, in the case of Mr. Givens, the program had been established by the county as part of its overall program. In the case of Mr. Speer, this was not really established directly as a program, but instead became part of a memorandum of a collective bargaining agreement, and that was the method under which it was established, not under this program that was equal to workers' comp, but rather under this separate memorandum of understanding. As well, under the terms of the program, the sick pay could not be paid out while a person was disabled, while you were receiving the equivalent of workers' comp payments. Rather, as the court points out, and as it was true in Mr. Speer's case, it might be paid out decades later, the accrued sick leave during that period of time. So the court found that it was not part of a workers' compensation program, and therefore not excludable. Rather, all of his accrued sick pay that he received when he retired was taxable income. But the court went on to point out one other thing. They said even if Mr. Speer had been able, and they'd agreed that this was somehow related to workers' comp, he had not shown, given the details of the program and the limitations of the program and the maximums you can carry over from year to year, how much of what he received would have been properly traceable to those amounts in any event. Therefore, the court held, even if the court was wrong in the initial point, which the court does not believe it is, but this sets them up for the appeal, that the tax court says Mr. Speer failed to demonstrate how much of what he had received was actually part of the workers' comp claim, was related to those times when he was on workers' compensation. So they held it was none. Key difference here, important takeaway from this case, because you may not represent any law enforcement officers in Southern California, but the key takeaway is the danger we run into sometimes by reading cases and case summaries and overreading them. At first glance, the Givens case looks like it's just perfect for Speer. It looks like, hey, we've got the justification, we should be able to exclude that, there is no problem. You always need to read cases a bit critically because your taxpayer's case is never going to be exactly like the case that went before the court. And you have to ask yourself, could any of the differences between what you know of the facts recited in the case that you're trying to rely upon and your client's facts be used by the IRS to show why the same result doesn't apply? As well, you quite often may need to ask the client for all kinds of additional facts, knowing that the IRS will do so, to try to see if there is a differentiating point or at least get a good argument out about why it's not differentiated, why this should not count against you. So just be careful in that area. Next, we move on to Chief Counsel Memorandum 2015-15018. This is a case of somebody trying to do, again, what sounds like it should be a fair thing, but it didn't quite work. A partnership had been operating for a number of years when, for reasons that aren't specified in the memorandum, it suddenly switched an important little issue for reporting. The partnership had always prepared its financial statements on the accrual basis. It had always filed its tax returns on the cash basis. Number of years after getting started, the partnership somehow accidentally started reporting its sales on the accrual basis. So it wasn't backing out the uncollected revenue each year. So it began reporting revenue as basically it was received. Now we fast forward, get to the point where one of the partners buys everybody else out, and suddenly the problem is found. And so this taxpayer discovers that in his view, he has more basis in the partnership interest than he should because he's recognized income he shouldn't have recognized. So he files a claim for refund asking for a loss deduction for a bad debt for the year in question. Now, there's lots of things wrong with the methodology used here, but let's go to the one that the memo was looking at. Was this a bad debt? And the memo concluded that no, it wasn't. The taxpayer was still on the cash basis of accounting. Remember, they'd been on that basis, they had reported on that basis, which is, by the way, crucial. Had they made this error from year one, My take is the answer would be very different, because then the method of accounting would have been a hybrid method. Despite what they checked a box on the 1065, the method would have been hybrid. And in fact, that would have been the method they would have been using, would have been reporting receivables when they were billed, not when they were collected. But they said since they swapped that way, what you really had here was you still had cash basis accounting and you still had zero basis in receivables. But you might say, wait, he reported income. Well, nice, but irrelevant. He had no basis in his receivables because proper reporting, which, by the way, he needed IRS permission to change methods and the partnership never got it. So the proper reporting is zero basis. Having no basis, there is no debt on which there could be a bad debt deduction claimed. Therefore, no deduction should be allowed. Thinking this through a little further, though, it gets even worse. The memorandum does not continue on here, but let's follow this through. The taxpayer has reported income in the past. The taxpayer should not have reported that income. And it was not that they had an improper method. They had a method they did not have permission to go to. Therefore, under the rules for methods of accounting, the taxpayer is deemed to have needed to have reported using the official old method. That meant that effectively these were errors on returns. And since these are errors, not methods, and the years are closed, these errors are going to result in no apparent way of recovering these overpayments. That, honestly, is a very, very bad result. So be aware of that. That was an interesting problem. And the problem lots of times is we see programs for Honest QuickBooks that offers taxpayers the right to have accrual basis reporting, but then also to run cash basis reports. It's not all that difficult to conceive of situations where taxpayers may not understand how to properly use those mechanisms in their software and end up ish creating reports and statements that may be used for tax preparation that in fact are erroneous methods of accounting. There's been accounting method swaps in the background that, oh, by the way, nobody ever noticed took place. So be careful of those inadvertent and unauthorized method swaps that can cause us problems. Next, let's go to the case of Tarigi versus Commissioner. I guess that's the best way to pronounce this, which is Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-28. This looks at the issue of when does a business commence under Section 195. The taxpayer in this case was an engineer who had 25 years of experience as an employee. As many of us have run into from time to time, such people decide as they get here now pretty far along in their career, they decide, you know, I really should go out and be my own boss. And he really decided this to a large extent around 2008 when the economy fell apart because he was basically a construction engineer and did a lot of highway jobs. So what he did was he went out and he established this business. He bought equipment. He established a business name. I'll phrase it that way. He bought equipment. He set an office up downstairs. And he went to various job sites to meet with people, managers, etc., that were involved in the industry that he knew, and to get his name out, pass out his business cards, etc. Now, he incurred a number of expenses, including buying all that equipment. And he, of course, sought to charge this off. Now, there are a couple of problems. He had no revenue. And, in fact, he had never actually bid on a job. The tax court took a look and said, you have to remember something, sir. Section 195, the startup expense provisions, disallows any deduction for expenses occurred before the commencement of an active trade or business, rather requiring you to keep them in abeyance and only pick them up in the year in which the business actually commences. As you may recall, those expenses that count for this are expenses of investigating the creation or acquisition of a trade or business, creating an active trade or business, or any other activity that would be deductible if you had done it in an operating trade or business. All of those must be held up and only allowed as a deduction when we actually start the business. As you may also, so you would accrue those if they were, you would keep them in abeyance. When you actually start the business, if they are less than $5,000, you write them off in the year there that you start the business. If they're more than 5,000 but less than 50, you write off 5,000, amortize the excess over 180 months. And if you go above $50,000, you begin to lose that $5,000 expensing dollar for dollar. But in Mr. Carrigi's case, none of this mattered because the court ruled he hadn't actually started a business. In determining whether a taxpayer is actively engaging, remember, he cannot do it till the year in which he begins actively engaging a trade or business, they look at whether he undertook the activity intending to earn a profit, whether he is regularly and actively involved in the activity, and whether the activity had actually commenced. Only one of those really could Mr. Tarigi show. He was, and the court agreed, he was out on job sites regularly, he was handing out cards, he was talking to people, so he was regularly doing something. But the court said the activities you had were more of a startup nature. And what they found crucial, two things. Number one, because he had never actually bid on a job, that was two problems. Until one bids on a job as a construction engineer, it's going to be a little tough to show you have a profit motive because obviously that's a key activity. Anybody in the engineering field would tell you, you actually have to bid on and get jobs. At least bid on jobs. He hadn't done that. And you're not going to get a job generally unless you bid on a job. So that's a problem. And because of that, he had neither shown that he had a profit motive, nor had he actually commenced the business because bidding on jobs is a bare minimum to commence this business, and he had not done that. As such, the court found, they didn't care about his documentation or anything else the service had asked questions about. They said very simply, no deduction would ever be allowed because you haven't started the business. Therefore, Mr. Tarigi was turned down. In the case of Lay and O'Neill versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-27, we have a little different situation. You may notice we've talked about here a number of times about a number of cases where the tax court has told a taxpayer who wanted to reconstruct logs to prove they were a real estate professional tough luck. Well, this taxpayer was a person, in essence, Ms. O'Neill. She was the taxpayer who was involved in the rental activities, and they had a dozen rentals, 11 that were single family and one condominium. They were located in Austin, Texas, and they lived at a ranch about 20 miles outside of Austin. When she was examined, she'd been examined before on this issue, so she submitted her logs for time involved in these properties, and she did repairs on the properties, she kept all the books on the properties, she did all the maintenance on the properties, so she had a lot of things she were doing. But when she turned in the logs, apparently she didn't add them up, but the agent did. The agent came up with less than 650 hours, basically, or I should say, just over 650 hours in the activity, less than the 750 necessary. So the IRS agent agreed that she met all of the criteria to have been considered a real estate pro and for these to have been considered material participation, but she hadn't met the hours. Now she went back and said, oh, I didn't put my travel time in. She went back to her calendar and reconstructed. Remember, she lives 20 miles outside of Austin. All the properties are in Austin. She could tell based on the details in her logs, she had very detailed logs, whether the activity in question took place at the ranch or in Austin. And every time she had an activity in Austin for that day, she would basically put down the travel time, the normal average travel time to go from her ranch to Austin and then from Austin back to the ranch. When we added those in, she was well above the 750. However, the IRS did not allow that. The IRS said they believe she must have included that travel time in her original logs. So we go to tax court. The tax court found the taxpayer credible, which is important. And number two, they also found her method of reconstruction to be not the kind of, you know, very imprecise guess that we've seen in the other cases, but rather a very precise calculation. They also found that under long grilling by the IRS agent or the IRS counsel in the case, they only found very minor inconsistencies in her records, so she was found to be believable. So this is a case rarity where the taxpayer actually won on that issue. Next up, Chief Counsel Advice 2015-15019. You may know that if a taxpayer is considered financially disabled, that is, they have a mental or physical diagnosable disability, that the statute of limitations for filing a claim for refund on their tax return is held in abeyance under 6015H. The question this memo looked at, though, what about, remember we have this special rule for net operating losses where if I incur a net operating loss carryback and I carry it back, then when I do that, I'm able to offset that loss against years that otherwise might be closed, because those years stay open under Section 60, under this section as well. Those codes stay open, are 6511D. Those years stay open for 3 years after the original filing date, including extensions of the return that generated the loss. Now, if that return is being held open under these special rules for financial disability, does the NOL stay open as well? And this memo concludes, based on how the statute is worded, that it does not. Any losses would be generated would have to go back to, because you're beyond the time period to elect to carry them forward if you discovered a loss on amended return. But you can't get the law, you can't get the taxes back, because that statute may have closed. This means this can cause real issues in the financial disability realm. Finally, if you had a taxpayer affected by the 1095A errors, remember we had a whole bunch of erroneous 1095As issued by the various marketplaces. Those are the ones you need for the health care credit, for the credit for health coverage. And they had those, they were issued, they were erroneous, they were wrong. If a taxpayer, in essence, had an erroneous one and incurs either a late payment penalty, an underpayment of estimated tax payment penalty, or an accuracy-related penalty, notice 2015-30 tells you about the IRS's relief provisions there, where they won't be penalized for any deficiency related to the late erroneous 1095A. It also tells you how to basically ask for that relief, or if you should need to, how you approach it. Specific language is given for how to handle this, including how to handle returns that have this issue, that you're filing now an extension. There also is, which you should be aware, because the deadline of this is April 15th, 2016, they've discovered some of the erroneous 1095As were issued to people indicating they could qualify for a credit when they did not have qualifying coverage, which is a base requirement for getting the credit. Any taxpayer who got a credit who did not qualify because they didn't have qualifying coverage, but they got the credit by following the 1095A, those will not be penalized, but only if those are amended by April 15th of 2016. So if you run into one of those, an amended return needs to happen basically by next April 15th, so it'd be nice to get on those relatively soon. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 20th, 2013, 2015. Go back a couple of years there. You can find all of our information on our website, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. That'll give you links to all the cases, more information about the cases, that Google Scholar information, how to put that in your browser, as well as we'll post updates on there during the week as events happen. I want you to come back next week when we'll talk about more developments in the area of federal taxes.